Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Okay, we did warn you about yesterday's podcast. I put out a not safe for work warning. I can assure you that will not be the case for today's podcast. But I did get one direct message about our podcast yesterday with Lachlan Marque and how do you pronounce the name? Swin. We call him Swin. Where we dropped a few. There were a few words that were not F-bombs. So I got this direct message. Charlie, I've been a Bulwark listener for a few months now and was so excited to play today's podcast in the presence of my grandparents because I know they would love it as much as I did. So I turned on the podcast and oh my Lord, 4 exclamation points. Grandma heard the first paragraph, clutched her pearls and passed out. I don't know if she will listen again, but Grandpa and I will be listening tomorrow. Good job. Love today's show. Okay. So I wrote back and I said, hey, thanks and sorry about that. And then this person wrote, no, LOL, just kidding. My grandparents have passed, but they really would have loved today's show. I really enjoyed the show as always. Great job. See, I wanted to think that actually Grandma was standing there when we started the show. So it turned out to be no, not at all. So joining us today is Sarah Quinlan, who has an absolutely outstanding piece in ARC Digital and is contributed before. Well, have you contributed before to the Bulwark? I'm trying to remember because we were in touch about something, but I can't remember if it ever actually came together, Sarah.
I have. Contributed a piece about abortion and culture, and then about Brian Sims.
That was fantastic. Okay, so let's talk about your piece in ARC Digital, where you wrote. Well, before we get into that, you considered yourself a conservative and a Republican for years, right? I mean, you used to be kind of a cultural political warrior out there.
Yes, it wasn't even something I really thought about. I obviously believed in the principles, but it was just instinctive. I was a Republican, vote for every Republican, support the Republican Party.
And defend conservatives when they were attacked, just assume that whatever was being said about them was probably unfair, so you had to reflexively defend, excuse, blame the lame street media. Right.
Exactly.
I mean, yeah, the whole formula. So you have this piece in ARC Digital. Donald Trump taught me a lot, though not on purpose. So tell me, what did Donald Trump inadvertently teach you?
His election was probably one of the most defining moments in my life, just in regards to the before November 8th, 2016, and the version of me after November 8th, 2016. I don't think I would have had the growth I've had if he hadn't been elected. And it was just very eye-opening to me to see, first of all, how much anger there was out there and that people were willing to vote for someone like Donald Trump. And so as a result of just the last few years, it's really caused me to open my eyes about things that I wanted to keep them closed to before that I didn't even realize I was keeping them closed to before.
Okay, so you wrote about this a couple of years ago, actually. You previously admitted that Trump's victory made you realize a number of things, looking around going, okay, what am I part of? Who are these people? Who am I? Talk to me about nuance. You wrote you weren't careful about nuance. What did you mean?
Yeah, I will admit, I'm pretty sure most of my friends didn't want to talk politics or current events with me just because I was so sure that what I was saying was right that I didn't think about their perspective or how persuasive I was being. I assumed because I was right, they would eventually get it. And I never thought about it from their perspective of listening to someone like me and what I was saying and how they would take what they would take away from that. And so Trump's election just really made me, probably for the first time ever, really start thinking about how I was saying things. And it made me realize that how I was saying things might actually be more important than what I was saying. I felt like there definitely was an atmosphere of anger and polarization that kind of really became obvious with the 2016 election. And I started worrying if I was contributing to anger and if I wasn't actually helping, you know, our country feel united, or if people were using my anger and my words to get angrier themselves.
Yeah, you wrote, I worried about how I contributed to an atmosphere of constant outrage. Okay, obviously, as I'm reading your piece, it resonated with me. Having been a conservative talk show host for more than 20 years in Wisconsin, and really thought of myself as kind of at the tip of the spear of the Republican Revolution of flipping Wisconsin from blue to red. And I always thought that I was reasonably nuanced, but I think that was self-delusion. And this was, I went through the same sort of process that you're describing here, where you step back and you go, okay, really, did I contribute to this? What did I say that was interpreted in this possible way? Now, I mean, there are some things that I knew when I was intentionally trying to stir people up. I'm going to admit that. I wanted people to be outraged about things that I thought were outrageous. But then I started to think that, you know, okay, did people hear things differently than what I said? I knew what I was intending. I knew where the bright red lines were, but maybe because I wasn't careful or because I didn't fully understand how it was being translated, maybe those red lines really weren't red lines. So, I mean, I experienced the same sort of thing, and that sort of looking in the mirror and going, okay, you know, I never thought this would happen, and yet it did. Did I contribute to it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you said that before Trump, you would often speak rashly or in the heat of the moment, without thinking of any potential damage I could cause. So give me a sense of what that was. Like, are you talking about college debates or when you're writing for, you know, something, you know, a website?
I would say with writing pieces and tweets, like there were definitely times where I would dash out a tweet really quickly, not thinking about if it would persuade anyone, if someone was on the opposite side of me, how they would take it, if they would find it, like, cause them to take a step back and think about what I was saying, or even people on my own side, if they would take it and then just run with it and use what I had tweeted to add on to their own tweets and then, you know, just contribute to the anger.
You quote a New York Post columnist, Carol Markowitz. Is that how you pronounce her name?
I think so, yeah.
Saying that she thought she had become a better person, more compassionate, less partisan, more aware of hypocrisy as a result of Trump. Which is, of course, interesting because generally the effect of Donald Trump on our culture has been a coarsening effect. So you felt the same way. I mean, so how does that work? How do you become, you're stepping back. You had obviously been, well, I'm going to project this on you because you don't sound obnoxious at all. You're basically saying you are angry and obnoxious and nothing about you sounds angry and obnoxious. So.
Well, thank you.
Well, not now.
Takes a lot of work.
Okay. So tell me about that. What is the work?
Honestly, especially with Twitter, I have seen firsthand how conversations that where I'm coming from in good faith and someone just assumes I'm arguing in bad faith and how easily the conversation can go from productive to unproductive, or watching other people fight on Twitter where they're both making good points, but they're refusing to really listen to each other and they're just going off of the assumption and the image they have in their heads of each other. That was something I really didn't want to contribute to anymore. And so I basically forced myself. I don't respond to every single nasty tweet I get. I usually, if I'm writing what could be a controversial tweet, I will have my husband look over it before I send it to make sure that, it's reasonable and that it makes the points I want to make. If I'm really angry, you know, I'll type it out an angry tweet and then I'll delete it or I'll save it as a draft and then, without fail, every single time I've lost my temper on Twitter, I just end up regretting it. So
we've been there. You had a phrase there that I think is important. Is this the assumption of goodwill? I'm extrapolating mm-hmm. from that. Is the assumption of so many of the debates that people are arguing in bad faith? And this, I think, is the one thing that if you step back from the tribalism, as you say, that you realize that people who disagree with you are not necessarily evil. They may have a different perspective. And I think that was one of the things that it was so easy to get caught up in, this us versus them. And particularly if you're a conservative, you felt you were under siege all the time. So you were kind of lashing out and being hyper defensive. And then you see what had happened, right? You saw where it led to.
Yes.
Correct. And it leads to sort of hackery. So you said you wrote, Trump's ascent to power opened my eyes in other ways, particularly after the bending of the knee by so many Republicans, including some I expected to have some integrity. Talk to me about that.
There were just definitely elected Republicans, Republican politicians who I thought believed the things that they would say that were genuine about believing we were all Americans. We didn't just wear red or blue jerseys, and believing in limited government, restricting power, things like that. And watching them defend the inexcusable has just been really eye-opening for me. Throughout 2016, as the field got smaller in the primaries, I started supporting Marco Rubio. Mm-hmm. My breaking point was, last year when Trump was considering hosting the summit at Mar-a-Lago, and Rubio just like accepted it. I know he would not have been okay if it was Clinton abusing her power and her connections and making money off of the office. So.
No, you know, I mean, this, of course, is, we've talked about this before, this sort of the long disillusioning slog of watching the invasion of the body snatchers. And early on, I mean, I was disappointed, but I understood the transactional nature of some of the folks who decided to go along with Trump. I mean, understand the people who would go, okay, everything we know about Trump, we know who he is. But, mm-hmm. you know, it's better than Hillary. At least we'll get some judges, or at least we'll get some good things. Or, you know, maybe we'll get 5% of what we want when we would get 0% from Hillary. So there was a certain transactional nature. But that has morphed into this willingness to fawn, defend, and rationalize, which really is amazing, because it does raise that question, doesn't it? Did you ever believe what you said? Did you ever believe that character mattered? Did you ever believe that you were in favor of the rule of law, or that the deficit and debt were major threats to the country? Or was that just what you said when it was useful to you?
Yeah, exactly.
You quote in this, Kateri, who wrote in The Bulwark, actually, the piece called Farewell to Hackery, and he wrote personally the same thing. He said that the Trump moment has taught me that politicians can be honorable no matter how wrong I think they are, and they can be complete hacks with zero principles, even if they like judicial originalism and entitlement cuts. Just because I think someone is wrong on most issues doesn't mean he is wrong on all issues. This might seem obvious to people more naturally ambivalent in their politics, or people older than me who had their eyes opened earlier, but I've come to appreciate that just because Democrats believe something doesn't make it inherently wrong, and just because something is on the Republican platform doesn't mean that it's necessarily good. But, you know, I'm not trying to justify it, but so much of our politics had become us versus them before Trump, where if you were a conservative, I mean, I used to argue, and this seems naive now, that conservatives believed that liberals were wrong on issues. Liberals believed that conservatives were evil, terrible people. Now I think that's evened out. I mean, that's...
I agree with that.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, there were definitely moments when I would admit to a group of friends that I was a Republican, and their reactions were just kind of like immediately shock. And so I completely agree with that just being a Republican in many ways was seen as being evil, but it has definitely evened out now, where both sides just want to believe the worst of the other side.
You know, and it is hard to have these reaching across the divide issues when you're constantly being accused of being a racist or a sexist or, you know, a liar. And, you know, look, things got very partisan in Wisconsin, you know, despite the reputation of Wisconsin Nice. But, you know, every once in a while, I kind of remember way pre-Trump thinking, you know, wouldn't it be great to sit down and just have a discussion with, you know, over a beer about how people feel about school choice and you know, even controversial issues like the right to life or the size of government or Act 10, all of these things. But it was impossible when so much of the rhetoric was so vicious. And it wasn't always, I know people do, well, don't get into both-sidism, but hey, listen, I've been there at ground zero. I mean, I know what mm-hmm. folks on the left said about folks on the right. And if you were for school choice, you were a racist. If you wanted tax cuts, you were a racist. If you supported John McCain, you were a racist. You know, yep. Mitt Romney was a racist. And after a while, it was like, hey, you know, we're not going to have a beer. We're not going to talk about this. And when you throw around words like racist, you know, quite frankly, a lot of conservatives are just going to roll their eyes.
That's definitely in part what I did before. I had my issues with members of the media, or really at the time, I had my issues with the media as a whole. I saw them as a monolithic entity. And so if there was reporting on something that a Republican in the past had done or said, I just automatically assumed that it was being covered in the worst possible way, that there was actually a reasonable explanation behind it, but the media just wasn't providing that.
You know, I will admit that when I was on the air, media criticism was very much, you know, part of the brand, because it was legitimate. I mean, I approached it as somebody being part of the media, in part because I wanted the media to be better. I wanted them to be fair. Yes. I wanted to expose them to their double standard. And we used to joke, but it wasn't really a joke, that something that was a felony for a conservative would be a misdemeanor for a liberal. And the double standards were just so obvious. The bias was so obvious. And so I actually worked for the radio station that was owned by the newspaper at the time, and people couldn't understand that I was allowed to criticize the newspaper. But part of it was, I was going, guys, do you understand that you are alienating half of your audience, that you are destroying your credibility by this kind of bias? And I was reading a story about the death of local newspapers the other day, and I felt a twinge of guilt because I always used to refer to the newspaper as the dead tree, and they hated it. But it was snarky. But those criticisms were legitimate. Now, agreed. That's different from saying that we want to destroy the legitimacy of all fact-based journalism, that everything you read about somebody is untrue, because that's kind of the scary moment. That's how you get to the post-truth culture.
I will say there are definitely some reporters now. I can see that the way that they cover Republicans compared to the way that they cover Democrats, the way that they feel about conservative policies compared to progressive policies. And I do not understand how they think that they are doing themselves or the industry a favor by being so openly subjective and biased. So I come down on the side that I think reporters really shouldn't tweet at all if their job is to report objectively, just because they do hurt themselves and you can see the bias. But I also think that there's more honesty than I believed when it came to some racism on the right.
Well, that's right. I mean, some of this was part of the shock, is to realize, well, you know, that perhaps some of the harshest critiques that they had offered may have been right. Maybe there was more truth to it than we were willing to admit at the time.
Yes. And I would not have realized that if it weren't for Trump.
No. And I've said the same thing, that you sort of think that some of those things are the recessive gene, or it's the loudmouth at the end of the bar, don't worry about it. And then you find out, wow, no, it was real. It was out there. And perhaps because I didn't fully understand it, I might have stoked it in some ways by doing some stuff. And really, I think that's the kind of introspection that people need to go into. So before we move on all of this, for people who are listening, trying to understand this phenomenon, though, there is a real power in belonging. There's a real power in political tribalism, particularly the way that it is morphed into. And that when you are part of that tribe, you belong to something bigger than yourself. And you knew that if you were attacked, others would defend you. And you were part of this social and political and cultural infrastructure. Right? I mean, it was part of who you were. It was part of your identity.
Yes.
And when you break with that, it's hard. There's a reason why people want to stay in the tribe, why they don't want to be picked off from the herd. And there's a tremendous reluctance on the part of, I think, a lot of activist conservatives, or were, to break with that. Because if you're going to go, you know, never Trump or Trump skeptical, whatever you want to call it, you are breaking off from the tribe and you're on your own. And that's a lonely place to be. And I think that explains why there are so few people who've been willing to do it, even though it seems sometimes, you know, a no-brainer.
Being Republican was a part of my identity. I felt very connected to it, as like I would look at it as, this is the party that Lincoln belonged to. This is the party of Reagan and Ike. Most of my family is Republican. I've been voting Republican since I was 18. And when Trump started gaining in popularity, I really expected the party as a whole to block him and to reject him. And when they didn't, it's still surprising to me how accepting people are of him, people on the right.
No, I was trying to think, like, what was the moment when I realized that I was irredeemably excommunicated? Because through most of 2016, in Wisconsin, most Republicans did hold the line against him. I mean, there was not, I think there was one elected official who was like a village president of a tiny little village somewhere, who was the only elected official that I knew of who supported Trump. So Republicans were behaving the way I expected them behave, you know, holding the line. Then when he got the nomination, you had that sort of centrifugal force, the gravity, and they decided to come around, and, you know, at least he wasn't Hillary. But even through the election, you thought, okay, but they will still resist the worst elements of Trumpism, right?
I mean,
I did too, and now looking back on that, that was really quite naive. So you write in this article that your principles haven't changed. So what are those principles? You know, the Constitution, limited government, free trade, free market, things like that?
Yep. I still consider myself a limited government conservative who believes in free trade and the free market and free speech, whether that's Section 230 or just political speech. And it just seems to me, from all the ways that Trump has kind of rejected those principles, it seems like the Republican Party just keeps rejecting those principles. Like, they follow where he goes.
Well, that's right. They're able to change their positions on issues. But so, you know, you haven't changed. It's the Republican Party that's changed. But you mentioned this in the article, you know, among in Trump world, though, conservatives who break with Trump, you know, are accused of, well, you just want to be liked by the left. You've sold out. You want strange new respect.
I hate that.
Why?
If I wanted to be liked by the left, I would become a Democrat. I would, support liberal policies. I would say liberal policies are better. I've completely changed my perspective on which policies benefit people and benefit America. But I'm not. I argue with liberals all the time about their policies. And I just think saying you just want to be liked by the left is a very lazy way to shut down an argument or a discussion that you don't really want to have because you don't want to get into the merits of it.
Well, yeah, and also you've sold out. You know, even for people who have paid tremendous political price for it. But there are some never Trumpers who really have been so shocked by the rise of Trump and what's happened to the Republican Party that they really have almost become indistinguishable from liberals. We do need to acknowledge that, right?
Yes.
I mean, there are divisions within the divisions. I mean, no matter how small the world of Never Trump is, it may be a tiny, you know, little remnant, but there's still, you know, differences between the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks and the people who are like, I'm going to vote for any Democrat no matter what, versus those of us who are like, no, we're still conservatives. Look, I don't know what the future of conservatism is, but I can tell you it's not socialism. It is not voting for Bernie Sanders. But there are people out there who have basically said that if Trump is the conservative movement and the conservative movement is Trump, then I'm not a conservative anymore.
And I think that's a mistake. I think this party, and I have so many friends who will disagree with me who were Republicans and have left it entirely, I think the party is still worth fighting for. I don't believe in just letting Trump complete a hostile takeover. And I think America needs a healthy Democratic Party and a healthy Republican Party. And I don't believe that the Republican Party will be healthy if we just leave it to Trump and Trump's administration.
But it's over, right?
I don't think so. I'm an optimist.
I mean, it's done. It's like 95%.
I get that reply a lot, and I see it a lot on Twitter that the GOP overwhelmingly supports Trump. But every single time I write an article like this, or an essay, really, I get so many replies and DMs from people saying, like, I feel the exact same way. I am so thankful that someone else said it. And that is part of the reason why, I mean, basically, I just write about my feelings, but that's part of the reason why is I know there weren't that many people consistently writing things I believed in when I first started writing. I didn't feel like my voice was represented. And I feel like a lot of times everyday Never Trumpers kind of get forgotten. You know, we saw in the 2018 elections that registered Republicans were voting for Democrats and that Republican women are leaving the party in droves. And it just seems like we kind of forget about all that when Trump supporters say Trump has a 90% approval rating. Well, is that because people left the party and no longer consider themselves Republican? And I know that there are so many vocal Trump supporters and former Never Trumpers who became Trump supporters or anti-Trumpers that sometimes I do question it. I wonder if maybe I really am one of the last few people who is steadfastly against Trump. And then I write articles like this and I just get so much feedback from people who feel the exact same way.
So you write that sometimes the Trump supporters often conflate professional Never Trumpers with everyday non-famous Republicans who believe in conservative principles. So who are these professional Never Trumpers you're talking about? Jim Swift and I are like looking at each other.
I would probably put Jennifer Rubin, Max Boot, in the professional Never Trumpers.
You just went there, didn't you? You just went right there.
I know. I may ask you to edit that out.
No. This is the fun part of it. So, and these are friends of mine, but they are people. Those are two names that will always come up with people who have basically repudiated conservatism.
Yes. Yeah. But I also think you can see them kind of taking a step back now where they were so Never Trump somewhat consumed their identity, just like being a Republican had consumed their identity, that they went all in on being Never Trump and Never Republican. And now they're kind of like, hey, Democrats, please don't nominate Bernie Sanders. Hey, Democrats, please like nominate someone Republican or former Republicans can help also vote for. Hey, Democrats, like don't lose this election. Well, I'm there.
With that, yes. With that, I, by the way, I appreciate particularly Max because his book, which I really did like, it is one of those that, you know, you write about how Donald Trump was sort of, his election was a shock to you intellectually and personally. It was also obviously a shock to him. And so he began to rethink everything going back to, how deep, these roots of racism and reactionary politics and authoritarianism is what, and it's a legitimate debate. And, I'm willing to have it with him that in fact, I think that this was not inevitable, that yes, there was that string, but there was also a much more legitimate stream of reformist, inclusive, free market conservatism that ought not to be thrown out simply because of Trumpism. But, this is part of the problem, though. You've mentioned the pleas to the Democrats, don't screw this up. I mean, so what do Never Trumpers do if the Democrats nominate Bernie Sanders? I mean, you know that a lot of the people, even people who are really disgusted and disillusioned with Donald Trump, are just not going to vote for Bernie Sanders. Are they going to vote for Trump? Are they going to sit it out?
I almost refuse to even start thinking that way or to start worrying about it because I am in absolute belief the Democrats will not nominate Bernie Sanders.
Really?
Of course, I was sure that Donald Trump would not get the 2016 nomination.
I'm having flashbacks.
Yeah.
Okay, so you don't want to go there, but this is going to be a hard year. Do you see yourself voting for a Democrat?
I could not vote for Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah, why not?
Too far for me. And I see people suggesting that Republicans should vote for Bernie Sanders in primaries. To try and get him the nomination because they're so sure that Trump will beat him. And it reminds me so much of Democrats voting for Trump in the 2016 primaries because they thought Hillary would beat him. And I just don't understand. I think socialism would be disastrous for our country. And I think it, in so many ways, goes against so many of our country's founding principles and what has made us prosperous and free and safe. And if you're that willing to put a socialist one election away from the presidency and from being the person who really leads the direction, the country in a direction, that's just a risk I don't even want to take.
Yeah, and also, this is obviously not an original point, but I have been struck over and over again by how the Bernie Bros online really feel like the Trumpists from 2015 and 2016. I mean, the personal attacks, the threats, the negativity, the way they swarm people, and the damage that they're actually doing to the party right now. And I'm, you know, look, I have a lot of problems with Michael Bloomberg. I have a lot of problems with Michael Bloomberg. But I was, I did think it was interesting that he is going after the Bernie bros, that he's, you know, calling them out and saying, look, you know, you keep talking about energizing and uniting this party. This is not doing that. You folks out there. So there's, you know, this, and I think there's sort of that fundamental question of whether or not, because, you know, you're describing a process when, and I really identify with it, of sort of stepping back from the brink and realizing, do we really want to head off into this extreme, you know, radicalized tribalism? And part of the decisions that can be made in 2020 is, does the country want a break from this? Do we want to return to some sort of a politics of decency? Or do we want four more years of revolution? Because Bernie is not going to be a let up. And it's not going to make the country less divided. It's going to take everything that we're talking about here, and it will just turn the dial up to 20. And I don't know, I'm sorry to go on here, but I keep getting people saying, yes, but Charlie, you know, because Donald Trump, you know, has such contempt for the rule of law, you need to vote for any Democrat against him. And by the way, I find that to be a very powerful, persuasive argument, because I am absolutely terrified about what a second term of Trump would be like. But I guess I find it unpersuasive that somebody who is, you know, has been a Soviet fanboy and a defender of Cuba's Castro and the Sandinistas, that person can really be trusted to restore the rule of law. I guess I'm a little skeptical there.
I'm as well. And just the policies he supports and the way he talks about, like Venezuela doing things well. And I just don't understand how he can say that with a straight face.
No, and part of the problem, I think, for Democrats and many of their supporters in the media is they have created a bubble within a bubble, and I don't know that they know what's coming if Sanders gets the nomination. I don't think they fully realize the mountain of Oppo research is going to be dropping on his head. Of course, we're seeing that mountain of Oppo research being dropped on Mike Bloomberg even as we speak here. So you make a final point in your article that I wanted to get to. You know, you obviously, you know, realize the danger of defending your team, which means, you know, being closed-minded, unwilling to listen to criticism, quick to assume that your team were the good guys and that the other team was engaging in bad faith, which of course makes things worse and worse. And then you quote James Baldwin. I love America more than any other country in this world, and exactly for this reason, I insist on the right to criticize her perpetually. So how did you go from the sort of recognition of the evils of Trumpism to James Baldwin? How has it changed your attitude towards patriotism?
I think in a lot of ways it came about because a lot of times when you criticize Trump, his supporters will kind of take that as a criticism of them. They'll take it personally. And I saw my own attitudes reflected in that when people criticize America or criticize the Republican Party. I think I took it as an attack on myself, and I didn't want to hear what they said, didn't want to see any faults or flaws. But by burying my head in the sand, that doesn't lead to improvement. I want to use my voice to help shape the conservative movement, to help shape our country so it can be the healthiest and the best country and the best party.
You know, I wonder if you had the same attitude that, as I was thinking about your article, the extent to which I had become, particularly when I was doing my radio show, had become used to using information as ammunition rather than as the jumping point for discussion or thought. And I think this is, at least that's what I'm reading here, is that criticism and a willingness to, you know, look at your own faults is kind of essential to improvement. But when you get locked into sort of tribal warfare, you just can't be open to any sort of criticism. You can't. So, for example, pre-Trump, conservatives really didn't engage in serious discussions about the problem of racism. And now I think it's like, okay, we really have to do this and sort of drop some of the defensiveness. Doesn't mean you adopt, you go along with like the, you know, 1619 project or something like that, or reparations. But I mean, there are moments when you need to engage in some very serious introspection.
Yeah, I think a lot about the, with regards to that, the line of, I don't see color, which I think is a very noble sentiment. But if you are refusing to see color, you're refusing, just because you are refusing to see color doesn't mean other people aren't. And it doesn't mean if you're refusing to see color, then you can't see the ways it's affecting other people and you can't see ways to improve it. And so that's kind of how I think of criticism in general, is just you have to be able to listen to the criticism and decide for yourself if it's legitimate so that you can fix it if it is.
You know, and that's, of course, the, unfortunately, part of the problem of having these discussions. And I still see this among progressives, is their willingness to assume that anybody that votes for Trump or is a Republican is doing so because they are a racist. Now, there are racists, but mm-hmm. that's really not helpful in some ways to simply, it's reductionism. It's a way of, it's a way of, you know, shutting down any discussion. So I wrote this in my book that I don't have any idea what percentage of Trump supporters or Republicans are racist. I don't think it's a, I don't think it's a majority. But what we've learned though is that the Republican Party and the conservative movement turns out to be very willing to accept racism. And that's in many ways just as much of a shock. They are willing to tolerate it. They're willing to look the other way. So none of these issues seem to register at all anymore. And that is kind of a shock because, you know, my vision of conservatism was sort of the Jack Kemp where Paul Ryan was taking it in terms of being inclusive. You know, even Reince Priebus was writing the autopsy of what the Republican Party should do. And I open up Twitter today and there's Reince Priebus at Stephen Miller's wedding.
Yes.
This guy's an overt white freaking nationalist.
And that's something that I, you know, two years ago, I would have expected the entire Republican Party to be up in arms about. And it just seems as though there's more silence. I don't want to say it's only silence, but there's more silence than I expected about someone like Stephen Miller, the emails that have come out, the things he said and promoted, and policies he supported.
Well, that window has moved because you think about that it was not that long ago that Republicans would have wanted nothing to do with somebody like a Stephen Miller when the kind of, you know, racially tinged offensive comments by a Tucker Carlson or a Rush Limbaugh would have been embarrassing to mainstream Republicans. And now they're not only not embarrassing, but, you know, they got the Medal of Freedom, and, you know, the number one host on cable news. So that's changed. There's something good about not being constantly browbeaten by the left and the media, but the price that we've paid is way too excessive. So on balance, are you optimistic?
I am an eternal optimist. So yes, I will always think that the outcome that I want is going to happen.
Wow. Boy, I'm,
but I also,
we need,
you know,
that on this podcast because we don't usually get that attitude.
Like I said, I write about feelings a lot and I hear from people who feel the same way as I do. And I just think they really get drowned out. There are a lot of people in this country who want to bridge divides. And I think too often we make generalizations and, you know, hopefully I didn't do that during this podcast, but we make generalizations, we group, because we see the worst of one section of people, we apply it to all people who share something in common with them. We divide ourselves into us versus them, whether that's like pro-life versus pro-choice, criminals versus non-criminals, legal immigrants versus illegal immigrants. We always have to have an other to go against. And so that's something that I really, with this piece and with many of my pieces, is I want to humanize the experience. I want people to realize that there are people who have these feelings and they have them in good faith. And I want, you know, liberals to be able to read me. I want Trump supporters to be able to read me and to make my writings as accessible as possible so that maybe we can come a step closer to, you know, bridging some of these divides and decreasing the amount of polarization in this country at this time.
Sarah Quinlan, thank you so much for the article, and thank you for spending so much time with us today on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. This was so exciting.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow and we will do this all over again.